This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Morning, everybody. Our special guests have arrived, beating the fog that apparently enclosed the airport this morning. It's easy to believe. When I was coming down to work this morning, I thought it seemed dense and thick, and you always think, oh, it's one of those days when, unless you're on the very first plane, you don't get out of Canberra and you don't get in. But welcome to Faye Anderson, who's made her way to the National Museum. My name's Matt Trinker. I'm the director of the National Museum of Australia, and I'm delighted to be able to welcome you all here today. Can I start by, as we always start at the National Museum for any event, by acknowledging that we meet today on the lands of the Ngunnawal Ngambri peoples. And I, on behalf of all of us, would like to offer my respects, pay our respects to their elders past and present. So welcome to this symposium about life on the home front in Australia in the course of World War One. It's very gratifying to see you all here for what I hope will be a thoughtful and provoking day of discussion about the experiences of Australians in this country in the course of that calamitous war. The battlefronts of the conflict are, of course, etched indelibly on the collective memory of this nation. And I think we all know the statistics, the horrible statistics. More than 60,000 died in all the theatres of war in which Australia participated, and many, many more were grievously wounded in the course of that war. And that terrible toll, I think, still affects the nation today and certainly did affect the lives of subsequent generations after that time. But as I've said before in the course of this year, it's an evident truth that most Australians experience the war in this country, far from those battlefields. And I think we should never forget the impact of the war at home, here. And it happened so soon after we had achieved the considerable success of bringing the Australian colonies together in nationhood, so that in a sense, very frequently, our retrospect has brought those together in our national narrative. That moment of nationhood and also the moment of the nation's presence on the international stage, sadly, at a time of war. The National Museum's Life on the Home Front exhibition takes us inside the biographies of Australians who experienced that war at home, and I think it's the case that almost everybody in the crowd would have seen the show this morning, if not before. And I hope that you had a sense of what life must have been like for individuals, a very broad range of Australians' histories that are presented in that show in the course of the 1418 war. And it really follows the museum's other great work in this area, the exhibition that we produced to show what the country was like on the eve of war in 1913 that we held a few years ago. And it's my expectation that we get, once we get to the end of this, what is effectively a rolling commemoration of the First World War that this country is experiencing, that we'll be looking to represent the nation's experiences in the aftermath of war at some time in the near future. But today you have a chance to think and discuss aspects of our home front history and to remember how subsequent generations have dealt and continue to deal with the trauma of this conflict. So I thank you really for your time and interest, indeed the interest that you have in a whole range of events that we hold here at the National Museum. And I know I'm leaving you in capable hands in passing the baton here on stage over to Dr. Michael Pickering, who is going to be the MC for today and who will introduce each of our speakers in the course of events. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt. Very conscious of time, and I welcome everybody. We're very pleased to have you here, and I hope you've all had a chance to go through the exhibition. And I hope that after today's session you have a chance to go through it again and see whether your opinions have changed or altered or whether it's become broader. We'd be very interested in any feedback that you may have. As the master of ceremonies, that really means housekeeping. I'd just point out for the toilets, or in 1918 terms, the dunnies, out the door, to your right again. The lunch and afternoon tea will be held in the hall. Please allow suitable walking time so we can get back and get started on time when we're coming back. The parking, if people are parked in the four-hour parking zones, please keep an eye on the time to make sure you don't get caught. And finally, the mobile phone, standard mobile phone message. If you can't turn it off, can you turn down the buzzers or the ringers or the cute little tunes that your grandchildren put on them, or children. All right, we have the themes for the day, of course, beginning with censorship, suffering and shell shock, followed by internment during World War I. Then after lunch we have war and peace on the home front, the shattered Anzac, afternoon tea, finishing with the August offensives on Gallipoli and their echoes in Australia. People will be invited to ask questions, again, depending on how we're suitable for time, but I'm sure there'll also be the great opportunity to catch up with people during the lunchtime and afternoon tea and at the end of the day to follow through on any questions. And on that note, and close on my time, I shall now invite Dr. Janda Gooding and Dr. Faye Anderson to the stage to take on the first session of Censorship, Suffering and Shell Shock. I'm glad I'm sober.
Good morning, everyone. As you can see, we haven't had a time to actually organise ourselves too much. I just want to remind everyone that on this day, 100 years ago, there was the second day of the Battle for Lone Pine on the Gallipoli Peninsula. Australians and Turkish soldiers were fighting across a small saddle of land, which the Australians had called the Neck. Early on the morning of the 7th of August, four successive waves of Australians climbed out of their shallow trench and tried to make their way across 30 metres of land to get to the opposing Turkish trench lines. They were mowed down. During the course of the 4 or 5 days around the Battle of Lone Pine, over 2,000 Australians lost their lives, and the Turkish estimate was approximately 6,000 men who had died. In April 1915, many Australians, of course, had landed on Gallipoli carrying small pocket cameras. But on that day, on the 7th of August, there were no cameras to record the events that happened at the Neck. Australians would have to rely on the words sent home by both the soldiers themselves and the press correspondents. For the war correspondents, Charles Bean and Philip Schuller, who were on Gallipoli on that day, they faced a perennial problem with their reports. Bean and Schuller were indeed willing participants in reporting the war. They supported Australia's involvement in the campaign and certainly didn't want to jeopardise the strategic imperatives of the action or, in fact, endanger the men. Yet as professional journalists, they wanted also to tell the truth about what they saw for the Australian people. Caught in this very conflicted position, they had to negotiate how to get through it. The words they sent from Gallipoli appeared in the Australian press over 2 weeks later. And the achievements of the Australians taking and then holding the trenches at Lone Pine certainly overshadowed the tragic events at the Neck. Ultimately, the Australians would have to find out for themselves the lasting impact the war had on the men who fought, their families, and indeed Australian society. The subject of how journalists negotiate this very complex environment and the relationship between truth and censorship is the subject of our first speaker's presentation today. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Faye Anderson. Dr. Anderson is Associate Professor of Journalism Studies in the School of Media, Film and Television at Monash University. I know Faye's work particularly through this book, which I've had by my side for the last few years anyway, when I've been at the War Memorial, that she co-authored with Richard Trembath. It's called Witnesses to War, The History of Australian Conflict Reporting. It's essential reading for anyone interested in the complex, practical and ethical relationships between journalists, the media and the media, at the military and the media. And I look forward especially to her new book on Australian press photography that she's working on at the moment, I believe, as a result of her ARC grant. So please join with me in welcoming Faye Anderson to the floor.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. I'll just give an overview, and I'm showing a number of slides, and I'm not expecting you to read them. It's actually to show you the coverage, both visual and also written, so you get an understanding as I'm talking. My work examines how Australian war correspondents reported on and also experienced trauma and psychological trauma in World War One. And I've deliberately put that photograph for it. Many of you, you'll know it. It's from that ill-fated campaign that Woolworths did. And it actually is almost an arch, if you want to think about it, how we like that sanitised vision of a man, a very beautiful man. He's known as the handsome man at the War Memorial. We don't know his name or his fate, but that's, of course, part of that sort of mythology. So I hope this works. Ah, yes, it does. Okay, I'm just going to give you an overview and then we'll be able to chat more specifically. But the Australian reporting during World War One differed from the British and American press for several reasons. Very few Australian correspondents were accredited during the duration of the war. There were only in total 9 journalists and 3 photographers, and only one, and that was C.E.W. Bean, remained for the duration of that period, and he was the one that lasted by far the longest. All were male, given the rank of captain, and using the contemporary parlance, were embedded. Correspondents saw themselves as part of the war effort. Charles Bean was noted by Keith Murdoch, the father of Rupert, that he was actually an incredibly astute, he had prestigious output, and no accounts of action could be more accurate or his sympathy for the suffering more evident. And in a way, Murdoch is true. Here, Bean does try and actually try to communicate more truth, and he becomes a bit critical of the Australians, but he discovers very quickly that the public don't want that truth. They don't want that candour. They want to actually have a more hagiographic view of what's going on. And the other point, of course, is his coverage starts to dissipate as the war continues because the newspapers don't like his more matter-of-fact, more accurate sort of reporting. They much prefer a hagiographic, an embellished record from some of the hotel warriors, as they're known, those that sit in hotels but were probably just sitting in camps. At the same time, Murdoch is also a little inaccurate because Bean doesn't have a great deal of suffering in a way for the men suffering because it's not prominent in the dispatches. And in a way, you've got to understand the way the press works and the culture of the time. So emotional vulnerability wasn't a welcomed aspect. The societal and the cultural norms didn't necessarily display this idea about psychological fragility. And it also is, of course, very... it's also very difficult to convey the truth because the Australians had two censors. They had the British censorship system and then they had the Australian censorship system. And the British censorship system was run by journalists or those in the press. The Australians weren't. So for the Australians, it was a double censorship. So he can't convey that sort of accuracy and truth. And Greg, quickly, from our is probably the best example. And also the newspaper culture as well. So we always assume that the journalists have the autonomy and agency. Those that are actually doing the captions are the sub-editors. So they have the autonomy and they actually dictate what is said. So the idea, even a year later, that the anniversary of Anzac legend landing is something to celebrate, and it was, in a sense, but they also, they use language that is particularly pointed. And from there, where over 5,533 Australians die in 27 hours is such an example. So this is described by the sub-editors as all is well on some front. So again, the journalists are actually quite determined, or being particularly, to try and convey the truth, but he's not allowed to. And in a way, we also have to understand the lexicon of war, which is striking. Samuel Hines claimed that when Ford Madox Hoffa lamented that there were no words for the reality of conflict, he was making a point about modern warfare, which might require a new language. The British, and by extension the Australians, went to war with the traditional rhetoric. Soldiers were not killed, they had fallen or had died gamely, it was a supreme sacrifice and the price we must pay. And the correspondents had little agency, and as I said, that idea about honour and duty and sacrifice and manliness had clear meanings. Empire meant the British Empire and a fine paternal thing, and God was an Anglican. And traumatised soldiers threatened the telling of this warrior narrative and were completely removed from this sort of story. Self-control was both central to both soldierly and civilian constructions of manliness, and the forbearance of pain and stoic endurance was the heart of masculine Christianity. Personal confessional reporting also contravened the journalistic barometers of the time. So that idea about I was there, I saw this suffering, doesn't occur in the reporting at the time. So, as I said, From Air is a good example, and you can see the images that aren't published, and I'll talk about the visual representation in a moment. And when considering how soldiers kept their mental stability, Bean believed they severed ties with their civilian self and acquired a fixed and limited set of emotional responses. And this could also be applied to the correspondents and the photographers, where I've looked at their reporting, but also their diaries and their letters, which convey far more candour. Very briefly, photographers have a particularly close relationship with death because their industry demands and rewards an intimate closeness to violence. The First War photographers fell into two main categories. Amateur, which we would now call as citizen journalists, were the soldiers themselves who were actually given cameras to document Egypt and Gallipoli, and then once they realised it was actually spiralling into bloodbath, the cameras were confiscated. And we had three war photographers, where if you think about the importance of visual now, it's almost unbelievable. The first was Herbert Baldwin, who was actually withdrawn after 6 months. He was discharged due to ill health, which was always a euphemism for shell shock, and Frank Hurley and Herbert Wilkins. Hurley and Wilkins had both been trained in the Antarctic, and they were both amazing photographers, but their work was never published in newspapers at the time. Their candour was not given expression, but nor was their visual representation. Instead, we had very staged and managed photographs. This, again, is a photograph by Hurley, and as you can see, this is an excerpt from his diary, but he wasn't given that sort of expression. Instead, even after the war, staged and manipulated photographs became popular, and though they were not published at the time, they appeared in a lot of the exhibitions that appeared. Now, again, this is a photograph that was actually used all over the place in the Gallipoli commemoration recently on The Guardian, which is a fantastic newspaper. But what they'd actually removed is they'd used it as a Getty image, and they'd removed the fact that it had been staged. Hurley also was a infamous manipulator of images. This image acquired 12 composites, so 12 different photographs were taken to create the one on the top of the left, which of course conveys something almost biblical. If the reality of war was not written, the public also didn't view the front line. Photographs in Australia have never been allowed to present a true account, and the searing, brutal images of our boys have rarely been published. They still don't. We have still yet to see, and I'm not advocating graphic imagery, but we don't see dead Australians, and when we do see wounded soldiers, they actually have to adhere to sort of iconography that is almost biblical or Christian in its way. In contrast, it was the unpublished photographs which provide a vivid tableau of unseen military life. Some captured the enormity of the battle and the nightmarish conditions. And I want to consider two very briefly. So this is what the public would have seen, these portraits of these young men. And as I've said, on the left, many of them have been wounded or died. And instead, these are the photographs also that were not published. This one, because of the young man probably in the middle who was seen to have shell shock or was certainly looking very damaged. And this one, which showed death and bodies. More than 100,000 Australians have lost their lives as a result of war service, but graphic photographs of our dead have not been published and are still not. And my work with photographers now, they have the same sort of pattern, which we'll talk about. While the issue of shell shock dominated modern psychiatry during World War I, the condition was not mentioned in the dispatches from the front line. Publicly, Bean avoided the issue of mental illness during the war and in his subsequent historiography. As Marina Larson says, and other historians have noted, there are no reliable statistics to indicate how many returned soldiers suffered from mental illness. Certainly, we have cases of 60,000 were killed and about 150,000 was physically or psychologically wounded, in addition to 700 reported accounts of self-inflicted wounds. Between 10% and 40% were said to have suffered battle fatigue or shell shock. Those who succumbed to mental illness did not have a place in the Australian Journalist's celebration of nationhood and masculinity. They were effectively, as Larson argues, failed Anzacs. And the pictorial invisibility continues, as I said. So while the cultural representations of trauma or shell shock, as it was referred to, came from the work of poets and novelists in Britain, the main narrators in Australia are the journalists and the photographers, but it's a very selective one. The journalists did not write about the suffering of others due to self-censorship, the censors and the press organisations, and in a way self-censorship as well. And the coverage of World War I offers important clues about the Australian press and military culture. Bound by these ideological and cultural values, the militarisation of journalism and the impenetrable censorship, the correspondents were unable to acknowledge the soldiers' psychological distress and their own. And for the people at home, of course, they knew what was going on, but only when they realised their young men weren't coming home or when they came home and they were utterly damaged. Thank you.
Thanks, Faye.
You want me to go back to the pretty man?
Thank you for that. We'll start with a few questions.
Sure.
And then open it up to the audience as well. You know, Bean and Shuler, as you said, have quite a complicated process getting their reports published in Australia. Can you outline some of the various stages of those sort of approvals or manipulation?
Well, Bean and Shuler, they would have written the copy and then they would have sent it to the censors on the front line. It depended also if it was printed, because they were pooled. Does everyone know what pooling is?
No.
Okay. So pooling is, there was only one official war correspondent, so all his work would have been pooled to other newspapers. So he would have written and then it would have been shared with all the other newspapers, which is sort of against the idea of competition and the scoop. So if it was pulled and was going to the British newspapers, it would have been censored by the British as well. And sometimes we know that the copy, it would take days and days. And also for Bean and Shuler, they weren't accredited straight away, so they were delayed for another month. So they would have sent it to the Australians on the front line, then they would have sent it to the British, then it went back home, and then it went through that process, and then the news editors, and we all know that different news editors have a different political agenda, so they would have censored it as well. And right at the basic of it, the correspondents might have censored it. So being after his Egyptian incident where he does talk about the men behaving badly, I think becomes very reticent. He quickly realises that actually he can't always convey the truth. So I think he's very careful in what he's reporting. And also he's reporting to people who are waiting at home and are very worried. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to necessarily traumatise people back at home. And then, of course, you've got enlistment issues as well. So it's so complicated, and there's so many different chains and levels it's going through.
Yes. Yeah. The situation on Gallipoli is quite different to what the Australian correspondents would encounter on the Western Front. And on the Western Front, Bean and others were very reliant on the British authorities for access to information, access to the battlefield, even getting transport out to various sites. How much do you think that reliance on sort of the military hierarchy compromised their position?
Look, everyone is very critical of Bean, and I am in some ways, but actually he still manages to go quite onto the front line. So after Fromère, he gets there the next day. So he's still managing it. He becomes very unpopular because he is trying to sort of report and stay with the troops. And he's injured, I think, 3 or 4 times. But then you have got a group who are actually what we would now say is hotel warriors that are sitting there waiting for the copy to come in from the generals and the political sort of players. And that certainly happened, and that had the most, that was very popular in Australia as it was in Britain, because of course you could then distort it and you can make it very colourful. Bean was known to be a little bit boring in his reporting because he did try and convey that sort of, you know, the unit went here and the unit went there. Mm. So, you know, he didn't indulge in that sort of flowery rhetoric. But the British correspondents actually became more popular in the Australian newspapers than the Australians, A, because we had very few, but also B, they were willing to use a lot more of that, of the copy.
Right. The war correspondents witnessed horrendous scenes. Bean in particular, you know, was in the front line often, was under fire, you know, was running from hole to hole for protection. How do you think it affected them?
Look, this is a project that I'm probably looking at after this, because I've interviewed, I think, probably over 140 war correspondents and then photographers. And what we would now know as post-traumatic stress disorder, it culminates in very complicated ways. I think Bean managed it. Certainly Baldwin didn't, who was the first photographer, and he was withdrawn and he died a couple of years later. They used euphemisms like, you know, ill health, or alcohol was very popular. Bean isn't actually according to type. He's really interesting because he doesn't fall into that sort of, you know, mythical sort of journalist, the hard drinking, the hard boozing, you know, a bit of a shagger, all of those sort of things that we think about correspondents. I think he warned his family, he warned his parents in a letter that he'd aged, you know, in 20 years or 30 years, I think he said, that they wouldn't recognise him. I think he managed it. I think Hurley, he then went into the Second World War, so he managed it as well. But I think also it's that time where they didn't talk about personal suffering. So when you read the diaries, there is a betrayal. You can see Hurley wondering if it's all worth it. But the camera, in a way, and it's very interesting, provides a really interesting barrier in terms of trauma. It mediates it in a way. And when I've spoken to photographers now, they say the trauma often comes later when they're looking at the images rather than the process of the time. So when they're reporting, and it's same with the journalists, they know it's just part of the job and they just do it, and the trauma comes later, if they acknowledge it at all. And some don't and some do. And I think this latest round, they will talk very openly about post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm. It's not seen as feminine or not macho, but certainly in those early years, they wouldn't have, I don't think they would have acknowledged it in the same way.
I think one of the really interesting questions is whether the model that was set up in the First World War actually has informed the way that current journalists are dealt with by the military in conflict reporting. Mm. What do you think about that?
Okay. I think the Australian system, I think in the Western media, and I've, as I said, and this comes from the interviews, our Australian military are the most secretive and the most inaccessible. It's very interesting, even with the Vietnam War, which we see as the uncensored war, Neil Davis famously said, you know, you're often told to F off if you even ask for the temperature. So I think that the Australian found a way of actually controlling it. You know, we think about embedding as a contemporary parlance, but actually the Australians have always done it. Mm. They did it in the Second World War. Vietnam was a little less censored. In fact, they could have access. But if you think about what we know about 100 years after Gallipoli, what we know about Afghanistan, what we know about our soldiers, it's very controlled. And the Australians, you know, they actually stopped all access and then they introduced embedding, trial embedding, when the Americans had done it from 2003. And the Australians implemented it in about 2005. But again, you know, bus tours, as the correspondents said. You know, and I have to acknowledge, of course, the media and the military have two very different roles. You know, the military's role is secrecy. The media's role is actually communication. So you can see why it's at odds. But I would say 100 years later, I could be wrong, we probably don't know much at all about our soldiers. And I think the problem with that is we don't know when they come back and they are experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder. We don't have any context, which I think is a great pity.
Mm. Mm. Okay, do we have some questions from the audience, please?
My right, you're.
Yes.
Bonnie Maywald from Queanbeyan. I read recently of the very different home front experience and response in New Zealand to what occurred in Australia in response to the Gallipoli campaign, the lack of information coming through, and in fact that the New Zealand government was almost unseated by the demands of the mothers of New Zealand, who were saying they had a right to know where their sons were, whether they were dead, buried, wounded, and they wanted to know now, not in 6 months' time. I wonder why there is a substantive different feel between Australia and New Zealand in that respect. Have you looked at that at all?
I know a colleague of mine was working on the New Zealand, the history of New Zealand war reporting, and her argument was that there was a smaller industry and they mainly had Ross, I think, who was a New Zealander. I actually don't know. And it's an interesting parallel and it's an interesting paradox. I'm sorry, I'm not much help. I don't know. Maybe Australians are more obedient. I know that's going against those myths about we're supposed to be egalitarian and anti-authoritarian, but I actually think that sometimes the Australians do tend to be a little bit more obedient about, you know, we don't question these rules. I don't think we still question these rules. So that's me speculating more than anything else. And, of course, with newspapers, it's quite bizarre because, of course, they do know what's going on in a sense because they can see the long casualty mm-hmm. lists and those images, those beautiful images of all those young men who've died. So there is that, and they know what's going on coming home. There was a great suspicion, though, and some of the public were very critical about that they weren't getting the truth. And you can just see the way enlistment worked. You know, the enlistment rates dropped substantially because they knew, even though the newspapers were saying, you know, all is well on the home front or all is well on the Somme, they knew that actually it wasn't going well. So it's an interesting paradox, but, yeah, I'm not quite sure. That was me speculating.
Other questions? Just put up your hand and the mic will come to you.
I'll come back.
You need two microphones.
Thanks. Can you comment on Bean's selection, if it was Bean's selection, of photographs for the photographic volume of the official history?
How he selected them?
Yeah. I'm sorry, I can't remember when it came out. Somebody else might know.
24?
Right, yep.
Yeah, Bean was a relentless archivist. So even when he was on the war front, he was going out with his assistant, who remained actually his assistant for the rest, you know, for much of his career. Bean took photographs, Schuller took photographs, and then he used Hurley and Wilkins. He actually was very critical of Hurley's composite images, which we would now call manipulation. So he collected everything. All the photographs actually were filed at the Home Office, so they weren't published, as I said. Some were, but none of the more graphic ones or the ones even on the front line of Australians. And then all those photographs were released. Does that answer your question?
Well, I'm thinking of then, if it's 1924, if there's a selection of photographs for a volume of the official history for sale to the public, what's the process then of selecting images, do you know, that to make it acceptable for a still grieving population?
Well, even with the exhibitions, the newspapers were saying that they're not showing anything of any graphic or upsetting nature. So they were still being very selective. And even with Bean's histories, Alec Rawes, who was a fantastic journalist who was actually killed, he enlisted. They were very reluctant. The Australian authorities were very critical of Bean using Rawes' diaries or letters because he was talking about shell shock. So there was still, there was still a great deal of censorship, more so, I think, in Australia than probably Britain at the time. And the Europeans always show much more graphic imagery, and they always actually have. Culturally, they tend to show more violence than we do.
So, Anne-Marie, I can add a couple of things about that process as well. I know that he ran selections past Wilkins to get his opinion on it. I know that some images were still censored, were still locked away at that particular point, and particularly captions were censored. So it was quite a complicated mix, and as you probably know, most of those photos had already, the ones that had been deemed acceptable by the censor had already been for sale for some years to the public. So I dare say he would have mixed, you know, both the public reaction to the images, what he had available, some colleagues' comments, and balanced all of that into the final selection.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
With regard to the history, Bean's history of the First World War, the last volume contains nothing but photographs. Are these graphic photographs, or are there any graphic photographs included in that publication?
It depends on what you call graphic.
Well, you were talking earlier about graphic photographs not being published.
I wouldn't have called them particularly graphic. They were still within the, you know, look, in a way, you can't see people's faces. The Australian soldiers, their faces have always been obscured. Yeah. The Americans started to publish in newspapers graphic photographs of their dead from 1944, in the Second World War, 1943, 1944. So there is a pattern. The more graphic photographs are more acceptable after the war, but still they're very carefully selected. And as I said, they accord with dignified iconography in a way. So, you know, they're very well, they're framed. And the other point is, with some of the images, is it wasn't unusual for photographers to move bodies. So they looked better, you know. And I know that sounds terrible, but Matthew Brady did it during the Civil War, where he'd go on the front line and they'd move bodies to make it look beautifully composed, which I know sounds very odd. So, yeah, so they did sometimes show bodies, but they're always obscured, and we were much more comfortable with the bodies of others than we are of our own. So German bodies were fine. Turkish bodies were actually okay too. Australian bodies, not so good.
Yeah.
Good.
Thank you.
It's another question.
There was someone over there too.
Last question, if we can. Luke, just fourth row up.
Can you just raise your hand? Hold on. It's just...
You've got two microphones too coming up.
There you go.
And now you don't have any.
Good morning. My name is Lindsay Ferguson and I live here in Canberra. Thank you for your address, Faye. My question relates to the photo. You've talked about the censorship process, so that suggests that there were many photos taken that nobody saw. Where are they now? Are they accessible?
Yeah, a lot of them are at the Australian War Memorial. So the two that I showed that hadn't been published, they're both at the Australian War Memorial. So a lot of them, I mean, and that goes with any archives or any memorial. The Imperial War Museum have the most amazing photographs as well. Often, I would argue, often it's the unpublished photographs that actually convey so much more than what is published. You know, what is unacceptable in terms of the censors or even the photographers, and what is deemed acceptable. And I think in many ways it's a clue to both the military, the politics, the public, and also the photographers themselves.
So I managed that collection. The photographs, although censored by the authorities, were not destroyed. And there are cases where being fought tooth and nail to make sure that those images were retained for the future record. So they weren't destroyed. Mm. They were just classified, in effect. So.
And online, you know, the Australian War Memorial Online, National Library, they do have a lot of those photographs. They're just, unfortunately, even now, they're used badly. They're not, you know, so the photograph of the Gallipoli, you know, running, I couldn't believe the Guardian actually hadn't said it was staged. So it was about, you know, share your memories about Gallipoli. That was the caption. But I'm thinking, share your false memories, because if you're going to use that photograph, please caption it. And it is that Getty. It is a problem when we have agencies using these photographs and having control of them.
It is. I think we're running out of time. One more, and then we'll need to move on to the next presentation.
Thanks for your presentation, Faye. I'm Peter Kane, and I'm a guide up at the War Memorial. I'm interested in a couple of things and so on, and we've touched on a bit just then, the myths that are created by journalism and so on, particularly the myth around the landings at Gallipoli that was created by Bartlett and so on. And the problem is people still believe those, and it's a real difficulty up the memorial. Have to keep on telling people we have to dispel the myths and so on. Fortunately, there are historians around trying to do that, Ashley Eakins in particular and so on. Hugh Dolan's another one who's come out recently with a lot of the things. My concern is how much of this continues to go on, that the stories were actually told and coming through the journalists and so on. How much of it is genuinely honest, or how much of it is coming from their own mind? Like, for argument's sake, and I'll go back 100 years, and you'd think we'd get rid of it after 100 years. Bartlett was sitting on the boat. He didn't get onto the shore until 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and yet he'd written this wonderful story about the Australians being killed left and right and so on, charging up the beaches. One soldier died on the beach in the landings at 4 o'clock in the morning, so, you know. Just
yeah,
crazy.
it's a hard one. It's very interesting because the correspondents, when I interview journalists, even now, they'll tell me who's a hotel warrior, who sits there and just smashes out official stuff and makes stuff up, and those, you know. But they won't. You can't actually. It's very difficult to actually, expose that. And it's also now because of the change in the media. We have far few journalists at the moment and photographers, so the only ones that are actually going out are the photographers. And you can think about this domestically. Mm-hmm. Journalists are actually sitting in their office, and because they have to cover 5 or 6 stories, so they're getting things offline. So a number of journalists that I interviewed who'd been into Iraq and Afghanistan were very frustrated because they were getting their editors saying, you've got to file 4 stories in a day, and look what the BBC are saying, because, you know, you've got to update that, and the BBC are saying it, so we have to say it. So they're not even allowed to, you know, to get the... to get the sort of confirmation that they used to get, you know, three sources as confirmation. So it's a historian's job. There are amazing photographers and journalists that try and impart that. But my concern is not just about the mythology and what is safe and secure, but it's also about a changing media that are actually have got less time to verify. They don't disappear the way they used to. You know, they're online all the time. And they're actually feeding the 24-hour beast and constantly updating, even if they can't verify what's going on. And don't even get me on Twitter and Facebook, which I love, but, you know, where is the verification? So it's a very good question. The mythology is... It's a massive... And the journalists that I know would say the same thing. They're very frustrated, but it's the nature of it. And also there are some wars where it's just too dangerous for our Australian journalists to go into. Who's going to go into Syria at the moment?
I think the woman up the back, would you like to ask your question, please?
Hi, Deb Jackson. I was just wondering, is it accurate to say that the censorship continued into the dioramas that were created after the First World War, because there was only one diorama that actually depicted blood? And the faces of the men in the dioramas, I've been told, were deliberately bland so that they couldn't be identified.
It's not my area. Would you know?
I haven't heard that before. And I know Anne-Marie's done a lot of work on the dioramas.
This is the thing about when you speak in Canberra. You know, everybody knows all sorts of things when you don't know it.
So, Anne-Marie, do you have a comment on that?
Oh, not really. Only that what we see in dioramas is probably a manifestation of the intent you see in official histories as well. So it's already been through a process of strict research and verification of details, and yet still a kind of a manipulation of results, so that, as I think they said, that it would be acceptable to a grieving community in Australia in the 1920s. I'd go like a really serious I haven't heard the thing about the faces being deliberately bland. We do know that one was based on an individual, David Twining. But you're probably right, they are faces you couldn't very clearly individual, I suppose, that's probably true. Because they have to transcend their mind, as well as be specific to a moment. They're very complex.
Okay. That's been a really interesting discussion. I hope we can continue some of it over lunch. And would you like to sort of thank me?
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Faye, again. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.